Measuring the growth rings in trees, known as dendrochronology, is one of the most well-known methods used by scientists who want to probe into the past of living things. As well as determining age, examining the rings of a tree offers science another method to study ancient climate. Earlier, I spoke to Danny McCarroll, Professor of Physical Geography at Swansea University. Danny, as I said, it's well known that counting rings can give us the age of a tree, but how does this kind of work give us clues to changes in climate?
The trick is to choose trees that are struggling a bit because of the climate. If you go up to the far north, for example, up in northern Norway, northern Finland, eventually it's too cold and you don't get any trees. So if you go close to that limit, they are so sensitive to summer temperature that the width of the rings is really like a thermometer.
So what kind of techniques do you use, and what is isotope dendrochronology?
Well, the big difference for us is that we look at the chemistry of the rings, specifically the carbon and the oxygen isotopes, and that allows us to look at changes in climate in areas where trees are not really struggling, places like Wales, for example. So the tree is just sitting in the environment. It takes up water from the soil. It takes carbon dioxide from the air. And it mixes those together to make sugars and then to make all the other parts of the tree. But there are just very subtle changes in the carbon and the oxygen as the tree grows. And those respond to climate. So even in a nice, warm, wet place like Wales, where trees look as if they're perfectly happy and not affected by climate very much at all, we get extremely good climate records.
Let's talk again about the extremes that you were talking about. So what do you learn then from examining trees at those extremes? I know you said that you'll get past a certain point on an alpine slope, say, where the trees will just stop growing. Yes. But if we're looking at climate over a chronological period, what kind of clues are there and what kind of story is being told?
Well, what we are most interested in Swansea is trying to use the climate of the past to improve our predictions of the climate of the future. In Europe, there are tree ring records that go back 8,000 or 9,000 years, almost to the end of the last ice age.
Okay, so where do you find those records? Because they're clearly not living trees, are they?
Well, there are a few very, very old living trees. The bristlecone pines from California, the oldest living trees, and we work with those as well. But what we tend to do is we take trees that live for a few hundred years, and then we try to find some archives of dead material. And that can be in Wales, for example, it would be in buildings, old manor houses, old churches. But if we go to the northern tree limit in Norway and Finland, we actually go into small lakes. And when the trees die and fall into the lake, it's cold water and they just lie there. They don't rot very much. So we can reconstruct chronologies that go back for thousands of years, just by matching the pattern of the rings, just like barcodes, and exactly the same as Paul has been doing for the shells.
And do you actually learn anything from fossilised trees? Because you mentioned that they end up in lakes. Fossilised trees are beautiful, especially in kind of cross-section. Is there anything to be taken from there, or is that almost too early in the story for us to learn anything?
No, there's a lot to be learned, particularly if we're interested in the effect of carbon dioxide levels on trees. If we go into the very distant past, then there have been very big changes in CO2. So that's an area of research which is really, really fascinating. It's not something that we specialise in Swansea because the methods that you use are slightly different.
If we're looking at our climate today, and you mentioned carbon dioxide and the important role that carbon dioxide plays, it's clearly a topic of concern about levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. What part do the world's trees play in the carbon dioxide balance of the planet, and how how much that story is being told by dendrochronology?
Well, they play a really crucial role because as we increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, luckily it doesn't all stay there. A lot of it is taken up by the oceans, by things living in the ocean, using the carbon dioxide, using it to make shells, for example, which then sink. But the other big way to remove CO2 is trees. If you increase the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, trees will actually grow a little bit more. So they put on more growth, more leaves, more wood, we hope. And so they store that carbon in the forest. So in terms of climate change, things are not as bad as they would have been if we didn't have so much forest. But the big concern now is, can trees continue to do that? You know, we're increasing the rate of increase in CO2 so rapidly that we're very concerned in Swansea that trees are not going to be able to maintain this role. In fact, that's why my colleague Mary Gagin is just off in Borneo. She's looking at how tropical trees behave in response to increases in carbon dioxide.
Can we talk finally a little more specifically about the kind of work and research that's been going on in Lampeter as well? Because I believe that there's been some very interesting findings. And generally, as you said, you tend to go to more extremes to either hot climes or cold climes. But, you know, Lampeter's temperate. And there's been some very interesting findings within the dendrochronology work that's been happening there.
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge shock to me, to be honest. And it wasn't me that designed this experiment. It was actually one of my colleagues, Giles Young, working with a good mate of his in Lampeter, Rod Bale and Nigel Nailing. We'd been working on carbon isotopes in trees in Arctic Norway, Arctic Finland. And Giles suggested we have a go in wet West Wales. And he just had this theory that the trees would respond very strongly to climate, even though their growth isn't controlled by climate, that the little holes on the leaves, the stomata, would change in response to humidity. And humidity is very closely related to temperature. So they collected some trees from Achlanlas, one of the big country houses over near Lampeter, and we got the most amazingly beautiful climate record. It really looks like a thermometer reading. And we can compare this now with the longest climate record in the world, which is the temperature record for central England. And the match is really quite incredible. The guys from Lampeter have just been to Dinevor Country Park, and they've got some beautiful old oak trees there. They've got a chronology now going back to the 1700s.
And I would imagine that if everything's tallying, it means that the science is irrefutable.
This is the key, because there's a lot of debate. If you've only got a short climate record, which is always the case in places like America, then if you calibrate, so if you compare your tree ring record with the climate record, the period you're comparing over is very short. And the last bit of it is all messed up by our activities, increasing CO2, messing with the forest. Whereas in Britain, we can go back to the late 1600s with temperature records. If it fits all the way back to there, we can be pretty sure that our record is as good as it gets. And I'm sure that with a bit more work in Wales, using building timbers and maybe some other sources, we'll be able to go back 1,000 years and reconstruct the real climate.
You're listening to the Science Cafe on BBC Radio Wales, and today we're exploring how scientists can delve into the past to study the changes in the Earth's climate over hundreds of years. Back here at Bangor's School of Ocean Sciences, I'm joined by the head of school, Professor Chris Richardson. And Chris, you brought us into one of the labs here. There's a couple of tanks here. We can hear water burbling into the tanks. Tell me what's in these tanks, because it's quite pertinent to the programme that we're recording today.
Well, we've got in here some interesting animals that we've collected previously. We've either collected these by divers or by a benthic grab or something like that. We brought them back into the lab, and we've put them into some aquaria and tanks containing sediment, mud. And these animals naturally live infaunally, that's in the sediment, they burrow down. This is Arctica Icelandica, the quahog. This is this very long, long-lived animal that can live up to 500 years.
And the older specimens are found in more northerly climes, in Arctic waters. Is there a link there between, you know, the coldness of the water and, I suppose, the slowness of their metabolism and their lifespan as well?
That might be something to do with it. We are looking at that in another related project, trying to work out why these animals have perhaps defied aging, the pre-aging process. They are feeding upon a range of organisms that are descending from the surface. So it may be that at depth, sitting on the bottom, because you aren't eating very much, that enables the animals to live a long life on the seabed.
Are there other species that you use, Chris, to study climate change within the shells, long-lived species as well? Because there's another tank next to the Icelandic clams that's got a different species in it. I mean, are they here for a similar reason, for similar research purposes?
They are. These are the dogcockle, Glycymeris glycymeris, and that's, again, a common animal that members of the public will find the shells washed up. They probably won't find the live animals. But these animals live to up to 200 years. So again, they've got the same kind of record that Arctica Icelandica has in its shell. I've got one here, actually. And these were picked up by a trawl. This is Glycymerus, the dog cockerel. And you wouldn't think that animal perhaps could live to 60 or 70 years.
No, because that's kind of, we've been looking at things that were palm-sized. You get four of those since your palm, I'd imagine. It's, it's a couple of inches across.
Well, the great value is that these two species live in different habitats. Mm. So Arctica Icelandica lives in mud. Glycymerus tends to live in more shelly, sandy gravel. Mm. So it allows us to piece together the picture of climate change on the seabed by taking species from different habitats. Yeah. So there's not always mud on the seabed. Mm. Sometimes there's not mud around certain areas, but there's sand and gravel. And yeah. So we can get records of environmental change from those kind of habitats with sand and gravel, which we couldn't do.
Fascinating.
With, yeah. Because there's no mud there, there's no mud species.
Now we're back and talking with Dr. Paul Butler at the School of Ocean Sciences here at Bangor University. Now you've clearly laid the groundwork here and an awful lot of research that's been done so far. Paul, what's the next stage in this?
Well, the next stage is to, specifically with the Iceland shells, is to get a temperature chronology. In other words, to get a temperature reconstruction using these oxygen isotope proxies for the North Icelandic shelf over the last 1,000 years or so. And that will give me a very nice, precisely dated, very high resolution, annual resolution reconstruction of temperature in the oceans. And this will be the first reconstruction like that has ever been done.
But it's the temperature in obviously specific parts of the oceans,
yes.
Isn't it? So is there similar work going on elsewhere in the world so that essentially a detailed global map of temperatures within the oceans is being built up over the last...
We want to build that up, but there's no other work like this going on in other parts of the world. That's partly because we don't have quite the same sort of long-lived proxy in other parts of the world.
Well, in other words, the clams.
Yes, yes. So if you go to the Pacific, for example, I think the longest-lived clams there are the giant clam Tridacna and the gooey duck, and they live for about 100 years or so.
Mm. And that's they're not no use because even
they are useful
because you can
to some extent.
Those. You talked about the you technique
do,
of overlapping.
You
the
can
clams.
Do exactly the same things. It requires more samples though to go as far back in time.
Yes.
So it's more difficult in that sense.
Mm.
So we're going to build this up, and what we're looking for here at Bangor is building up a network for the North Atlantic Ocean.
Mm.
So we're trying to get funding now to sample in other parts of the North Atlantic Ocean, particularly around the Faroe Islands off the northwest coast of Scotland and off Norway.
And once you've built up a picture for the North Atlantic, even though you don't, or it's harder to get readings for elsewhere in the world, I suppose you can still apply that information. But I mean, how applicable is it to the South Pacific or...?
Possibly more applicable than you might think, because the North Atlantic Ocean is actually a very important area in the context of global circulation, because it's where a lot of what's called overturning happens. Essentially, warm water goes to the top, to the North Atlantic, and then sinks.
Mm.
And this kind of helps to drive global ocean circulation.
To the Gulf Stream.
So yes, absolutely. Yeah. And by looking at the North Atlantic, you actually have quite a large part of the important drivers in global ocean circulation. Although, of course, there are many other aspects going on in other parts of the ocean as well.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I think it's the second time I've visited Bangor University School of Ocean Sciences to see the clams in there. I mean, I was going to say that they're kind of quite a pragmatic creature, but there's an innate beauty to them as well. And the fact that they can tell us these truths is quite an amazing thing. So I'm with you. When you go to those dinner parties and they say, what do you do? I study clams. And they go off in the corner and say, well, he's a bit strange. I'm with you, Paul.
I am.
Now, that's it for this week's edition of Science Cafe. If you'd like to find out more about the clams and the kind of research that goes on here, there'll be a whole panoply of links on our website and a link to the BBC iPlayer where you can hear the programme again. bbc.co.uk/Radio Wales and select Science Cafe from the menu of programmes.